Night Search. I'm Eddie Middleton in Memphis, and I'm talking with Laura Knight tonight. And we were talking about her work in exorcism, and we're leading up to a discussion of her work on The Matrix, but with just a few more things I want to ask you about the exorcism thing. And you were talking about this woman that the man got the possession from to begin with because he was having sex with her, and that's when the possession took hold of him. Exactly how does that work? Is his soul, like, more open during that time? I've heard Al Bielek was on our show last week. He said that at the point of sexual orgasm that the conscious and subconscious unite, and that would be a time when they could program people, like with the Montauk, you know, thing where they had the Montauk boys and they did those kind of things. Would that be a time when one would be more open to be possessed?
Well, that's certainly a good comparison because it does seem to be so. The problem comes in, I think, it goes back again to this self-serving agenda. Whenever two people interact with one another, the chief problem seems to be that they are interacting with an individual who has a certain, say, physical appearance. They then project onto this person with this certain physical appearance qualities that they may not possess. We all are probably pretty familiar with this because of our relationships with other people, that very often we think somebody is something and then after a period of time we discover that who we thought they were is not who they are.
Right.
Sometimes it's very very heartbreaking to come to that realization.
Yeah, I've been through a few of those scenarios.
Yeah, especially if you're married to the person and you have children with them, and then you finally have to realize or accept, face the fact that this person is not at all who you thought it was, and then either you decide you're going to like them as they are, or that you can't live with them as they are.
I was thinking of Shakespeare in one of his sonnets, he's talking about his mistress. He said, "I swore thee fair and thought thee bright, but thou art as black as hell, as dark as night."
Well, there you have it. So what happens is that when two people interact, and if they have, each of them, a false image of the other, they are each interacting in a self-serving way. I mean, I'm trying to convey a kind of a very subtle concept here.
Mm-hmm.
So when at the point of orgasm, they are each believing deep in their heart something about the experience and the other person that is essentially a lie because it has no basis in objective reality.
Mike could comment that the moment of sexual orgasm, one is the most vulnerable, you know, in a state of maximum, for maximum deception, let's say it.
Right, and if you are in this deep belief in a lie, even if you're believing this lie very innocently, then you attract into you lying forces. And depending upon the depth of the lie and the strength of the lie and the power of the individual soul believing the lie probably resonates into the universe and attracts into that void a matching frequency.
That gives a whole different twist of meaning to the saying lying with somebody.
Yeah.
It's a euphemistic way of talking of sex about sexual intercourse.
Yeah, so I hope that kind of explains how it works, because once again we're talking about frequencies, we're talking about energies, we're talking about, you know, the universe as waveforms of frequency and energy. And when you produce frequencies and energies inside yourself, and those frequencies and energies intensify through the electromagnetic activities that go on during sexual intercourse and at the point of orgasm, you are indeed very vulnerable to that which you believe. If you believe a lie, you are vulnerable to a lie.
And being possessed by lying forces.
Right.
Yeah. And that's how he came to be possessed.
Right. So.
Well, what was the final my outcome with his story and with the woman he was associated with. How did it all finally play out?
Well, after I nearly killed myself taking care of his situation, I spent, probably 4 or 5 hours a day for, 10 days afterward counseling with him. It took me several days before I was even able to play the tape to him to explain to him what had happened to him. Because, like I said, what do you do when somebody thinks they just have a self-esteem problem? You break it to them gently or as gently as you can that, hey, you had a demon. This was serious. Mm. And he was feeling really good, and, we got him to the point where he was in really good shape. And then I played the tape for him. He understood what had happened, what had gone on. I explained to him, listen, you have just had major surgery here. We got you all cleaned out. The cancer's gone. We've got you bandaged up. You're all sewn up. Do not play in the dirt.
Mm.
And he was good for a few weeks. And then he began having contact with her again, which he really couldn't avoid because they had a child together.
Yeah.
And the contact with her led to, of course, ultimately being reinfested, and he called me in a panic. And at that point, I did not see any reason. If a person cannot take their medicine, if they can't stay out of the dirt, and I knew at this point in time that, to put it bluntly, those some bitches were out to get me.
Yeah.
And the next time I worked with this guy, they were going to come back with reinforcements. They were going to be laying in wait for me.
Yeah, I hear that they do bring in heavy reinforcements during some of these exorcisms.
Oh, yeah. So at that point, I told him that I was not going to do another exorcism, that there were other ways and means that he would have to work on himself, that if he was uncomfortable enough to be motivated to work on himself, that he would have to do certain work in order to prepare himself to eject this thing more or less by the strength of his own will, which in the ultimate sense, that's where it has to end. It has to end with the person doing the work on themselves to be able to take care of this sort of thing themselves. I gave him a whole series of tapes, I gave him books, I gave him a whole, program of things to do, and it was just too much like work. It was easier to go play in the dirt and then go back and have somebody clean him up.
Yeah, but what about the woman? Now, was she seeking help for her possession, or was she not even really aware of being possessed herself?
Well, he brought her to me at one point during the course of this whole interaction for an interview, and I talked to her, and I actually, in order to even schedule an interview with her, I said, I want you to write an essay for me, and I want you to, write into this essay something about your background, something about your thoughts, your feelings about things, and she wrote about 20 pages. And I still have that 20 pages, and you have never read 20 pages of more revolting, disgusting rambling in your entire life. And, this girl was in a really, really bad way, and yet she would sit in front of me and use the foulest language you could possibly imagine, talking about, I went to the bar and I went outside and we, blankety-blanked and blankety-blanked, and there was five guys, and I loved it, and so on and so forth. And then when I mentioned the idea of spirit attachment or, possession or whatever, if I have any problems like that, I'll just go down to the church and they'll take care of it for me.
Yeah, they did already.
Well, but there was no point in telling her that, because when I pointed this out to her, she actually got very angry. And once again, you just come face to face with the fact that people suffer what they suffer until they learn how not to.
You might say they had made their bed and they had just decided to go ahead and keep on lying. And
right, until it got miserable enough for them to do something about it. It was too easy for them to just come and say, here, take care. It was like, Mama, pick me up and carry me. Well, guess what? You got to learn to walk. Mm. And people don't like to be told that they've got to learn to walk.
Well, let me ask you now about the demons. Where they reside, you say, in the fifth density?
This is what we call it. It's a completely ethereal state of existence, has no physical manifestation.
Are they eternal beings? I mean, they've always existed and always will exist, or?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, they cycle around, I'm sure. I think that when some of these demonic type beings, of course, you know, their objective is to become one with God in the same sense as those who serve others, you know, seek to become one. But they seek to become one with God by stuffing all of existence inside themselves, by absorbing all other beings, you know, to self, because they perceive God as the center of their being. And what happens is they gain so much weight, so to speak, that at a certain point they implode on themselves and they become primal matter.
Jeez. In a sense, isn't that the ultimate goal of the left-hand path?
That's what it is. But of course, once again, they don't realize or understand that the end is as primal matter. They just want to go back to sleep in eternal oneness.
Now, they don't recognize God as a being that has above them, that has the higher authority.
Right. They are God. They are God in the sense that, you know, they themselves, an individual, you know. It's one thing to say that God manifests in all of us. We are all God, and that we honor all other selves as God. They do not do that. They say, you know, God is within me, and the best way to, you know, get back to God is to serve that God that is in me specific individually, you know, to whatever point it needs to be served so that it can grow and get stronger and bigger and deeper and heavier and more slug-like. Of course, they don't say that part of it.
I'm reminded of Aleister Crowley, you know, and he says, do what thou wilt. And
yeah, there you go. That's it. And that's their whole their whole perspective, and that is ultimately the alien perspective as well.
Let's talk about the aliens now and how they are relating to these demonic beings.
Well, remember now, we're talking about a completely different manifestation here, because we're talking about another layer of, we're talking about layers of reality, and this is something that is described in some of the most ancient literature, the, you know, what they call the seven layers of reality, or the seven steps of Brahma, the seven sages, or the seven rishis, or, you know, any, the 7 days of creation.
We talk about the seven heavens, too, don't we?
Well, so seven heavens may be something altogether different, but then it may be the same thing. But essentially, we're talking about seven layers of reality.
Mm-hmm.
We are at the third layer. There is a fourth layer that is above us, and it is an intermediate layer. Say that if you take your number seven, and you have the highest level is seventh density, which it basically is everything, and then you have the reverse of the coin of seventh density, which is matter, primal matter, and then in between this mirror of primal matter and all potential of seventh density, you have these five other densities, two of which are completely ethereal, two of which are matter that is not conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this intermediate layer of fourth density, which is paraphysical. It is a physical density. It is a physical level. This is the alien reality.
Yeah, I've heard David Icke talk about that. This is where the reptilians reside, in the fourth density.
Right, and unfortunately, I think that he's gone a little overboard in trying to understand it in terms of demonic existences, because demonic beings are truly quite different. As I said, they don't communicate, they don't interact. I mean, it's very difficult to get anything from them at all. And in terms of this alien reality, we still have, quite an interaction, quite a hierarchy going on. But for the most part, it serves self. It acts like the shepherd on many occasions, you know, taking good care of the sheep so it can and can have dinner and warm clothing.
Yeah, we're primarily now talking about the reptilian beings.
Well, reptilians, greys, you know, what do you call them? The
Nordic
praying mantis.
Praying mantis being.
Yeah, the Nordics, so on and so forth.
Now, they are all in the fourth density.
Right. There's a whole range, and when you go through some of the literature, you just realize that there's just a whole range of them. And if you think about the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below.
Uh-huh.
And if we look at our reality, and we think about it in terms of different functions of society, different types of people. I mean, we have all kinds of different intellectual levels. We have different emotional expressions. We have people who are bankers. We have people who are the ruling elite. We have people who are doctors, lawyers. We have ordinary workers. We have people who are perfectly happy to dig ditches all their lives because, you know, for them it's satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing holds true with these higher levels of reality, this fourth density level of reality. If we look at the density below us, second density, and we look at the lower levels of it, the plant life, and then the intermediate levels, you know, that are more basic forms of life, but they're animal life, and then the higher animals, you know, on up through you know, the companions of man, the apes, the chimpanzees, so on and so forth. You see all different kinds of levels of being. A level doesn't necessarily constitute a judgment in terms of greater or lesser. It just constitutes a different type or a different expression.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing holds true with the fourth density level of reality. For example, the grays, what we call the Zetas. They are biobots. They are not quite plant life, but they are what you would call bioengineered beings of the reptoids.
I've heard that.
And they are, and there are several varieties. I've got an interesting document that was passed to me a few years ago that actually supposedly was smuggled out of some kind of military study, and it has pictures, and I've got them on my website. I scanned them and put them on the website, of different kinds of alien beings that have been encountered by some of these people working in these underground facilities.
Well, before you go further, why don't you go ahead at this time and give out your website address?
Okay, it's www.cassiopeia.org.
And spell Cassiopeia there for
you. Okay, it's C-A. Cassiopeia.org. It's an unusual spelling.
They can see some of these photographs of these grays on your website.
Well, they're drawings. They're not photos.
I mean, oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Right. And but interestingly, quite a number of them seem to be bioengineered beings with specific functions.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing about the grays is from what I understand, and this is not just from our own material or our own work, but this is from doing some research in the material of other people and things that they've discovered or ferreted out, it seems that some of these grays, they've actually taken some of them and crossed them with human-type genetics and created a little bit higher level being that comes across as having some, you know, intellectual capacity.
Some capacity for emotions?
Well, I don't know if you'd even call it emotional capacity, although that they can mimic that. And I'm sure you really are familiar with human beings who can mimic emotions. So just consider, if you will, the ability of human beings do all of the things that they do, and then jack that up about 100 times an order of magnitude to this higher level of reality, and you come to a realization that these beings, even these low-level Zeta types, can mimic certain things about human beings in such a way, in a robotoid way, that we can't tell the difference.
And I've heard now that some of these gray hybrids work in these underground bases, and some of the possibly the Delta forces might have some of them on the team? Or
well, I wouldn't say that it's impossible, because whatever's been going on this planet's been going on for many thousands of years, because, you know, we've certainly found tracks of it in very ancient literature. The most ancient shamanic customs of the Altai shamans in Siberia describe their function as being that of ascending to, you know, climbing the tree of life, so to speak, ascending to another level of reality, either above, as in the heavens, or below, in the hells, to bargain with the beings, the spirits, they call them, to release their hold upon the patient, the shaman's patient, and also to remove objects that are implanted in their bodies by these beings.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a tradition thousands of years old.
Well, Laura, we're right here at our break time again. We'll be at our last break here before we wind up the show tonight. We're going to take another 5-minute break, and we'll come back, and then we'll start to wrap things up, because I definitely want to get into some other areas here before we let you go tonight, because I'm totally intrigued with everything you've had to say so far, but I definitely want to get in and talk about this manipulated matrix thing more.
Okay.
Okay, you're listening to Night Search, and we've got Laura Knight on. We'll be back shortly.